You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 112, The Way of the Bandit. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. I couldn't do it without you. And, as always, I'd like to invite the rest of you to join us on Patreon. I just released the 21st of our special patrons-only bonus episodes. This one was one of my favorites. I dug into the surprising biographies of two colorful Napoleonic generals who emigrated to the United States, and we talked about Napoleon's taste in music. You can get access to all the bonus content, plus ad-free versions of the regular episodes, for just $2 a month. Visit patreon.com/ageofnapoleon to sign up. Anyway, we left off last time in the spring of 1808. A massive French army under Marshal Joachim Murat was in the process of a slow, stealthy occupation of Spain, despite the alliance that still technically existed between the two countries. By this point in our story, the regions along the Pyrenees were all occupied by French garrisons, as was much of northern and central Spain, including the capital of Madrid. Napoleon's soldiers were an unwelcome presence almost everywhere. The atmosphere was tense in French-occupied cities and towns. There had even been sporadic, small-scale, violent confrontations between French soldiers and Spanish civilians. This crisis, combined with Spain's long-term political problems, had produced a stunning turn of events at the very top of the Spanish government. The hated Prime Minister, Manuel Godoy, had finally been forced out of office by popular unrest. In the ensuing chaos, King Charles IV had abdicated the throne in favor of his son, who would become King Ferdinand VII. The news of Godoy's fall and Ferdinand's rise had sent a wave of euphoria across the country. Those who knew Ferdinand well generally considered him to be a person of low character, but the public did not know him well. They saw him as one of the few who had dared to stand up to the loathsome Godoy, and were eager to see him exercise his new power. But the future of the young king's reign was already in question. French authorities in Iberia refused to recognize Ferdinand as king. Meanwhile, his father, the former King Charles, had begun to regret giving up his throne so easily. Within weeks of his abdication, he was telling people that he had been coerced. He had even signed a letter to this effect and given it to the French ambassador. The people of Spain seemed convinced that Ferdinand's accession to the throne was a sign their country's troubles would soon be over. But as you can see, the danger had not passed. Spain was still on a knife's edge. Anything could happen. Bonaparte invited all the players in this drama to the city of Bayonne, in southwestern France, not far from the Spanish border. He told the world he wanted to mediate this dispute among the royal family, settle once and for all who was the legitimate king of Spain, so the country could move forward. Last episode, we focused on the Spanish perspective and didn't talk much about Napoleon's thinking. He had been wrestling with this question of what to do with Spain for years. The country was an ineffective and unreliable ally. That much had been clear for quite some time. The weakness of the Spanish government had made them both unwilling and unable to contribute much to the war effort. It would be hard for them to enforce the continental system over their massive coastline. Spain was also vulnerable to invasion by the British. If the Redcoats landed somewhere on that long coastline, the rough terrain and poor infrastructure might make it difficult to bring in French forces to oppose them. The Emperor was also aware that the Franco-Spanish alliance was deeply unpopular. Godoy had demonstrated this very clearly with his attempt to betray France back in 1806. Something had to be done about Spain if Bonaparte's new order was to triumph and endure. With much of the country occupied, including the capital, Napoleon considered Spain already conquered. He said as much to his senior political advisors. The question now was what to do with it. Did Napoleon have the right to dictate Spain's destiny? Well, I think by any reasonable standard, the answer has to be no. but hopefully by now you're aware that the Emperor didn't trouble himself with such questions. That was particularly true by this point in our story. Since the Treaty of Tilsit, Bonaparte was convinced that Europe was almost set to rights. The continent just needed a few more geopolitical tweaks to get the continental system working as planned. Then Britain would be brought to its knees, and Europe could embark on a new journey towards peace and prosperity, under Napoleon's guidance. He was so impatient to get this process over with that he was increasingly willing to use naked force to make those tweaks, whatever was necessary to get through this dangerous period of conflict and begin the process of consolidating the continent under a new geopolitical order. In episode 109, I read a quotation from the Austrian ambassador to France, the very perceptive Clemens von Metternich, which included this sentence, quote, "Napoleon seems to think that he has reached the point where moderation can only present him with useless complication," end quote. Bonaparte believed the final victory and a permanent peace were close. All that was needed was a big final push, and then everything would fall into place. And so, he was willing to push as hard as necessary. So Bonaparte was resolved to do something about Spain, but what did that actually mean? The emperor had contemplated several options. He had considered tightening his grip on Charles and turning him into a puppet. He had considered ousting Charles and ruling through Ferdinand instead. He had even considered directly annexing the developed, dynamic regions along the Franco-Spanish border into the empire, which would have left the Bourbon to rule a much smaller, Atlantic-focused country, more like its neighbor in Portugal. However, as we discussed last episode, the events of the preceding month had totally destroyed Napoleon's faith in the Bourbon dynasty's ability to rule Spain, even as powerless figureheads. Publicly, he claimed this summit in Bayonne was intended to settle the dispute between Charles and Ferdinand. Privately, he had already resolved to depose both men and give the crown to a candidate of his choosing. And so, in April of 1808, the members of the Spanish royal family began leaving for France. Ferdinand traveled like a superstar on tour. Everywhere he passed, he was greeted with cheering crowds. When he stopped to rest, notable local citizens lined up to meet him and offer their well wishes. He would eventually disappoint them all, but for now, Ferdinand inspired adoration, even love, in his people. Many were convinced he was walking into a trap. They begged him not to go. "You can't trust Napoleon. Stay in Spain." Apparently, some of them even offered to disguise him or spirit him away, convinced their beloved king was being taken to Bayonne against his will and was looking for an escape. In fact, young Ferdinand was walking into a trap, and it might have been better for everyone if he had accepted one of these offers. But he waved them off. He believed he could convince Napoleon to back the new administration, if he had the opportunity to talk to the emperor face to face. This was the man Napoleon planned to depose, a king who was so popular he couldn't even pass through small villages without being mobbed by admirers. A French intelligence officer monitored Ferdinand's progress through Spain and warned the emperor of the king's unprecedented support. But Bonaparte seems not to have listened. Charles and Maria Louisa's trip to Bayonne was very different. There were no cheering crowds. In fact, the former king and queen were so unpopular that they needed a French military escort. After what had happened at Aranjuez, Charles no longer trusted his own country's military to protect him. They avoided populated areas and kept a low profile. Despite his fall from grace, Napoleon still considered Manuel Godoy a player in Spanish politics, and so the sausage maker also got an invitation to Bayonne. He had to travel in complete secrecy, avoiding towns and even major roads, guarded all the way by a massive French military escort. Amazingly, the events of the preceding month seemed to have changed Napoleon's opinion of Godoy. Around this time, he wrote of the sausage maker, quote, "This poor man deserves pity. He has spent a month hovering between life and death, always threatened with extermination. The Spanish nation has shown an unparalleled inhumanity here. They attribute the most absurd things to him." End quote. Nothing angered Napoleon more than betrayal, so this is a pretty stunning about-face. Only about 2 years ago, he had been so angry at Godoy that he had contemplated abandoning his campaign in Poland just to teach him a lesson. I wonder if the emperor's low opinion of the Spanish people and the Spanish royals had convinced him that anyone they rejected couldn't be all bad. The meeting between Ferdinand and his parents at Bayonne would be their first time seeing each other since the controversial events at Aranjuez. It went about as badly as it possibly could have, ending with Charles attacking Ferdinand, trying to hit him with his cane as Maria Luisa shouted curse words. As father and son were separated, I wonder if Napoleon felt more confident in his decision to remove these people from power. Surprisingly, Bonaparte actually came to like Charles during this period at Bayonne. Charles may have been a disaster as a king, father, and husband, but he was an affable character, and despite all his flaws and failings, people did like him. The same could not be said of Ferdinand. Like almost everyone who came into close contact with the young king, Napoleon instantly disliked him, telling Talleyrand, quote, "His character can be summed up in one word, sneak. Ferdinand is very ugly, very wicked, and very much the enemy of France. It would take a very long war to make me recognize him as King of Spain." End quote. That last sentence is particularly fascinating in hindsight. Bonaparte would be forced to eat those words many times in the years to come. You might have noticed that Napoleon said this to Talleyrand. Although the wily ex-bishop was no longer France's foreign minister, he was still a member of the Council of State, and still close to Napoleon. Talleyrand had one of the greatest foreign policy minds in the world, and the emperor still relied on his advice, even though the two men had increasingly divergent ideas about French geopolitical strategy. Talleyrand was against this idea of removing the Bourbons from power and imposing a totally new monarch on Spain. He was a true diplomat. He believed in acting with subtlety. This plan was about as subtle as a kick to the face. Talleyrand called it, quote, "bushwhacking, the way of the Corsican bandit," end quote. Once Ferdinand and Charles got a hold of themselves and the summit at Bayonne truly got underway, it went about as you would expect. Napoleon held all the cards, and not only that, he was infinitely more intelligent and much more forceful than the hapless Spanish royals. The emperor employed one of his favorite negotiating tactics, browbeating his weaker counterparts into accepting his point of view. It wasn't very subtle, but it usually did the trick. The Spanish royals had been expecting a mediation, and instead they were getting strong-armed. Apparently at one point during the summit, an exasperated King Ferdinand went out to the balcony of his bedroom and screamed out to no one in particular, quote, "I have been betrayed," end quote. I wonder if he was starting to regret rejecting those people who had offered to help him escape. Napoleon had planned to make use of Godoy during these talks. The Prince of Peace had not been brought to France purely for his personal safety. You might assume that the ever-ambitious, always-scheming Godoy would have been happy to get back in the game, and eager to regain some of the power and influence he had lost over the past month. However, when Napoleon approached the sausage maker and asked him what he wanted out of these talks, Godoy responded that he had no interest in participating. His only request was that he be allowed to keep his titles and properties so he could retire in peace. Maybe those 2 days he had spent hiding under his carpet, fearing for his life, had led to some much-needed reflection on the ways he had abused his power and mistreated others. Or perhaps it was the experience of nearly being lynched by the mob. Surely he must have thought it was all over. Perhaps his life flashed before his eyes. Or, Godoy being Godoy, perhaps he simply realized that he had finally worn out his welcome. He no longer had any cards to play, so it was time to cash out while he still could. Whatever the case, the sausage maker would play no further role in Spanish politics, except maybe as a cautionary tale. Meanwhile, back in Spain, the situation continued to deteriorate. Ferdinand had left behind a regency council of trusted noblemen to rule in his name while he was out of the country. The French did not recognize Ferdinand as king, and so they certainly didn't recognize the regents either. The council immediately came into conflict with Marshal Murat, who considered the country without a government, making him the de facto supreme authority in Spain. Incidentally, Murat's wife, Caroline Bonaparte, was busy lobbying her brother to place Murat on the Spanish throne. Perhaps the flamboyant cavalryman had let this idea go to his head. On the street level, French soldiers continued to act like an occupying army, and the Spanish population had come to resent them like an occupying army. King Ferdinand's most fervent supporters among the common people of Madrid began to agitate and organize. These Fernandistas, as they were called, believed their beloved king had been deceived by Napoleon, and that something nefarious was underway at Bayonne. And, as we've seen, they were not wrong. The Fernandistas were increasingly convinced something had to be done imminently to prevent the country from being swallowed up by Napoleon's ambition. However, no one in charge seemed inclined to do anything. The Regency Council and the Madrid city government bickered with Marshal Murat, but didn't take any concrete steps to stop him or his men. Every day, the indignities and outrages of the occupation mounted, but it seemed nothing would spur the authorities to action. Anger and frustration were growing. On April 30, 1808, news reached Madrid that Napoleon had requested the entire Spanish royal family to come to Bayonne. Not only Ferdinand, Charles, and Maria Luisa, but the whole family, including the former king's younger children and grandchildren. There was no obvious reason their presence would be required for a mediation between Ferdinand and Charles. Many Madrileños saw this as confirmation of their suspicions about whatever was going on at Bayonne. Crowds of angry Fernandistas formed outside government arsenals and army barracks. They asked the authorities to open up the weapons caches and distribute arms to the people. If those in power were not willing to defend the royal family from the French, the people were. Of course, even if many in the Madrid city government sympathized with the crowd, the prospect of opening up the arsenals was obviously terrifying. It would almost inevitably have led to an unspeakable massacre. Cooler heads prevailed, and the crowds eventually dispersed. However, after this incident, word spread among the Fernandistas that the rest of the royal family was scheduled to leave from Madrid's royal palace in just 2 days. They resolved to be there. Early on May 2, 1808, French Colonel Auguste Lagrange arrived at the palace to conduct the rest of the royal family to Bayonne. He was clearly not expecting trouble. He brought just 20 soldiers with him, and they were from the Spanish army, not the French. As final preparations were made, crowds began to form in the square outside the palace. The Fernandistas knew a French officer had entered the palace and were determined to prevent the royals from leaving. As you might imagine, the mood turned ugly. Lagrange was worried he might be lynched. Fortunately for the colonel, word of this threatening assembly had reached Marshal Murat's headquarters. He dispatched a whole battalion of the grenadiers of the Imperial Guard, along with several cannon, with orders to clear the square. They did so in brutal fashion. At around 11 in the morning, the French opened fire on the crowds with musket and grapeshot, then moved in with the bayonet. The Fernandistas had come ready for a fight, but faced with the seasoned veterans of the Grande Armée, backed up with grapeshot, without any weapons of their own, they didn't stand a chance. Most ran. The few who tried to resist were cut down. But that was not the end of things. Far from it. The people fleeing the square had not been cowed into submission. They filtered through the neighborhoods of central Madrid, chanting, "Death to the French!" This was music to the ears of many in the city, and the crowds actually grew larger. That battle cry was no hyperbole. As news of the atrocity in the palace square spread, the people of Madrid wanted revenge. They took up kitchen knives, butcher's tools, and even scissors. Others pried up heavy paving stones out of the streets to use as clubs or missiles. All over the capital, any French soldier caught out in the streets was attacked. Many were killed or seriously wounded. At the royal jail, 56 prisoners petitioned the warden to be temporarily released so they could fight the French. Amazingly, the warden was sympathetic to the cause and agreed, on the condition that each one of them swear an oath to return once the uprising ended. The convicts gave their word and were given weapons and released. These types of urban uprisings saw some of the most brutal fighting of the Napoleonic Wars, perhaps second only to colonial combat. Generally speaking, it was understood by all the combatants that the victors would massacre the losers. No quarter was asked, and none given. Once it became clear what was happening, Murat and his officers responded quickly. Soon, French units were out clearing the streets. Perhaps unsurprisingly under the circumstances, they were not too careful in distinguishing insurgents from innocent civilians. Anyone who seemed like they might be a threat got a bullet or a saber. The Spanish authorities ordered everyone to stay indoors. Many of them probably sympathized with the rebels, but the uprising was almost certainly doomed, and more fighting would likely mean more destruction and more reprisals. These orders to stay indoors applied to the Spanish military units in the city as well. Apparently, officers actually locked their men inside their barracks. They must have been burning with shame, knowing that average civilians were out fighting and dying for the country's independence, while the men who actually wore Spain's uniform sat idle. However, near the center of Madrid, at a facility known as the Monteleon Barracks, there were two junior officers who couldn't bear the indignity, Lieutenant Luis Dawis y Torres and Captain Pedro Velarde y Santillan, were prepared to fight. The Monteleon Barracks was what was known as an artillery park. Almost all of the cannon in Madrid that belonged to the Spanish army units stationed in the city that were not part of the defenses were kept here, in one central location, for ease of maintenance and logistics. That morning, as they had a few days earlier, crowds formed outside the barracks, demanding arms. Unlike the authorities in charge of every other arms cache in the city, Dawis and Velarde agreed. Muskets, swords, and pistols were distributed, and cannon were prepared for battle. Members of the crowd entered the barracks. There were only a few dozen men stationed at Monteleon, and they would need help to defend the facility in the battle that was sure to come. Marshal Murat was no fool. He knew how valuable artillery was in this kind of urban uprising. You might remember that he had caught Napoleon's eye all the way back in 1795 by securing the cannon from Paris's artillery park during the uprising of 13 Vendémiaire. Now, 13 years later, he dispatched a large force of mostly German troops from the Kingdom of Westphalia under General Jacques Lefranc to secure Monteleon and its valuable cannon. Lefranc and his officers were probably expecting the garrison to simply hand the facility over. Remember, this was an almost entirely civilian uprising. The other Spanish military units in Madrid were all locked in their barracks. However, instead, they found a defensive perimeter around the facility and were greeted with musket and cannon fire. The Westphalians charged, but against all odds, the insurgents held them off. Captain Velarde and Lieutenant Dawis turned out to be charismatic and inspiring leaders, and the presence of the trained soldiers of the garrison steadied the armed civilians, who made up most of the barracks defenders. The fighting around Monteleon took on the character of a real pitched battle. There were a lot of weapons stored in the barracks, so the defenders were well armed. They had good positions and capable leadership. General Lefranc and his officers probably couldn't believe what was happening. They had woken up a few hours ago believing they were in friendly territory. Now they were locked in hard fighting, taking casualties. Finally, after months of invasion and humiliation, someone had stood up to the French and given them a real fight. The defenders of the Monteleon barracks fought with almost unbelievable bravery and toughness. Sadly, they were completely doomed. The fighting in the rest of the city was scattered and totally uncoordinated. It had not been planned and had no leadership. This was a spasm of righteous fury, not a real battle. In military terms, Velarde and Dawis and the brave band inside Monteleon were surrounded by vastly superior forces, with no possibility of escape or relief. They almost certainly knew this, but they were resolved to fight. The French attacked again, and again were repulsed. The battle was going much better for the insurgents than anyone could have reasonably hoped, but time was not on their side. More French reinforcements continued to arrive. Soon, there were roughly 2,000 men in the vicinity of the barracks, facing no more than a few hundred Spaniards, most of whom were not even trained soldiers. The French charged a third time, and this attack succeeded in overwhelming the defensive perimeter around the facility. Many of the insurgents were killed, including Captain Velarde, and most of the cannon were captured. The survivors fell back into the barracks buildings to make a last stand. Lieutenant Dawis was wounded, but as the only remaining officer in the facility, he remained in command, giving orders, sword in hand, as blood poured from a bullet wound in his abdomen. The French fixed their bayonets and began the hard, bloody work of clearing the buildings. Dawis was killed, but the now leaderless defenders held on and kept fighting, although they were now trapped and giving up ground. Finally, after 3 horrible hours of fighting, a Spanish government official arrived on the scene and convinced the remaining defenders to lay down their arms. By now, it was the late afternoon. Realistically, the insurgents had never stood much of a chance of actually defeating the French, and by now, Murat's troopers were in control of the city once again. Sporadic violence would continue into the wee hours of the morning, but as darkness fell over the city, the uprising was quelled. At the royal jail, 51 of the 56 prisoners who had been released to take part in the uprising returned as promised. 4 had been killed or captured in the fighting, and only 1 had broken his word and taken the opportunity to escape. Murat ordered his troops to arrest anyone carrying a weapon. As we discussed, the vast majority of the insurgents had been armed with nothing more than household tools, and so the definition of weapon became very expansive. There are stories of people being arrested for carrying sewing needles. The suspected rebels were tried the very next day. These proceedings were short, and Murat's officers were not in a forgiving mood. It's probably a stretch to even refer to these kangaroo courts as trials. For one thing, the proceedings were in French, a language which almost none of the accused could understand. As you might imagine, almost all were convicted. They were then taken a short distance outside the city and executed by firing squad, generally in batches. These tragic events have been immortalized in Francisco Goya's painting, The Third of May, 1808, one of the most iconic images of the entire Napoleonic Wars. Goya was a liberal. He had sympathized with the French Revolution, and some people even considered him an afrancesado, or Frenchified. But the things he witnessed on the 2nd and 3rd of May, 1808, changed him forever. He would devote much of the rest of his career to exposing the horror and folly of war in general and the French occupation in particular. The uprising and its aftermath had a similar effect on many madrileños. These events made a huge impact on the society, culture, and even geography of Spain's capital, which is still evident today over 200 years later. The former site of the Monteleón barracks is now a public square, the Plaza del Dos de Mayo, which is dominated by a monument to the brave defenders of the artillery park. The Malasaña neighborhood of central Madrid is named after Manuela Malasaña, a local teenage girl who died fighting the French. There are streets, parks, and statues all over the city dedicated to the insurgents. The Dos de Mayo has gone down in history as the first blow of Spanish freedom, the doomed cry that rallied the nation to resist Napoleon. It is certainly a very romantic, if tragic, story. Average people daring to defy one of the most celebrated armies in history. But the significance of this event is only really obvious in hindsight. At the time, many people outside Madrid, and especially outside Spain, didn't take much notice of the Dos de Mayo uprising. The violence of that day had been extremely intense, but other than the fighting at the Monteleón barracks, it had mostly been fleeting. Almost as soon as the uprising began, the French had mobilized and began retaking control of the city. The casualty numbers are not as high as you might imagine. Estimates of the French dead range from a few dozen to about 150. A few hundred Spaniards were killed in the fighting, plus a few hundred more executed on May 3rd. Those are significant numbers when you bear in mind that Madrid probably had well under 200,000 residents at this time. But still, this was a smaller affair than, say, the Revolt of Cairo, which we covered in episode 46.
Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections oder Excel-Superkräfte?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Ich fühle mich plötzlich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Abgabefrist 31. Juli.
Was?
Schaffst du ganz entspannt mit Wieso-Steuer?
Ach, ja.
Back in Bayonne, Napoleon was unconcerned. In fact, he seems to have believed the uprising worked to his advantage. He told his stepson, Eugène de Beauharnais, quote, "We took advantage of this affair to disarm the city," end quote. He said to Talleyrand, quote, "The good lesson which has just been given to Madrid must necessarily settle things," end quote. The emperor was also able to use these events as leverage in his ongoing talks with the Spanish royals. The uprising had been launched by Ferdinand's supporters, so Napoleon accused the young king of orchestrating these events, or at least failing to rein in the Fernandistas, although how he could have done so from Bayonne, where he was practically under house arrest, was an open question. Amazingly, former Queen Maria Luisa actually agreed with him and suggested that Bonaparte have Ferdinand hanged, her own son. These events of May 2nd, 1808 should have been a warning to Napoleon and to France that the people of Spain would not accept their country's subjugation. But the emperor turned a blind eye and plowed ahead with his plans. On May 7th, 1808, Stage 1 of the scheme finally succeeded. Ferdinand and Charles were, at long last, bullied into signing documents repudiating their claims to the Spanish throne, in favor of Napoleon Bonaparte. However, Napoleon would not take the crown himself. Apparently he was content being Emperor of the French, King of Italy, Moderator of the Swiss Confederation, and Protector of the Confederation of the Rhine. Instead, he passed this dubious honor to his brother Joseph. Of course, Joseph already had a crown. He was King Giuseppe I of Naples. So this would work like an internal promotion at a modern corporation. Joseph would step up to be king of the larger country, and the Neapolitan throne would pass to Marshal Murat, a consolation prize in case he felt passed over. Interestingly, Joseph was actually Napoleon's second choice. He had first offered the throne to younger brother Louis Bonaparte, the King of Holland, but Louis had turned him down. Bonaparte released a proclamation to the people of Spain. Quote, "Spaniards, after a long agony, your nation was at the point of perishing. I saw your miseries and hastened to apply a remedy. Your grandeur, your power, form an integral part of my own. Your princes have ceded to me the rights of the Spanish crown. I have no wish to reign over your provinces, but I am desirous of acquiring eternal titles to the love and gratitude of your posterity. Your monarchy is old. My mission is to pour into its veins the blood of youth. I will ameliorate all your institutions and make you enjoy, if you second my efforts, the blessing of reform without its collisions, its disorders, its convulsions. I have convened a general assembly of the deputations of your provinces and cities. I desire to ascertain your wants by personal contact. I will then lay aside all the titles I have acquired and place your glorious crown on the head of my second self, after having secured for you a constitution which may establish the sacred and salutary authority of the sovereign with the liberties and privileges of the people. Spaniards, reflect on what your fathers were, and on what you are now. The fault does not lie with you, but with the constitution by which you have been governed. Conceive the most ardent hopes and confidence in the results of your present situation, for I wish that your latest posterity should preserve the recollection of me, and say, he was the regenerator of our country." End quote. I think Napoleon really believed this. His private statements about his ambitions for Spain very much echo the sentiments in that proclamation. As we've discussed in past episodes, Spain had been in a precipitous decline for over a century. Napoleon saw ineffective governance as the root of the problem, and he believed a little French-style reform could put the country back on track. Ironically, despite the unscrupulous and pig-headed way he was going about it, I think he was probably right. Spain was terribly administered. Its system of government was antiquated. The church was too powerful, and the aristocracy was too powerful. The government was weak, corrupt, and far too decentralized to properly manage the country's affairs. Basically, every institution in Spain was in desperate need of reform. Napoleon's mistake was not in misdiagnosing the problem, but in believing that he, a hated outsider, could impose foreign solutions on a very complicated and deeply entrenched system. Still, despite the ominous events in Madrid, the plan seemed to be moving forward. The Spanish aristocracy was summoned to Bayonne to swear fealty to their new sovereign and draft a constitution. This would be the first written constitution in Spanish history, although, as you can probably guess, the Spanish nobles were not actually given any say in its contents. This would be a French-style constitution, drafted by Frenchmen and imposed by the French army. Despite the circumstances, most of the Spanish nobility obeyed. They dutifully made their way to Bayonne and played their assigned roles in this charade. As we already discussed, the events of the Dos de Mayo were still generally not being taken seriously. You could make the argument that the abdications of Charles and Ferdinand had been coerced, and thus were not legal, but what court would rule on this matter, and who would enforce their decision? As the saying goes, might makes right, and at the moment, most of the Spanish aristocracy didn't see any alternative to Napoleon and King Jose. The new constitution was approved, and Spain's new monarch prepared to make his journey to his capital. As for the now former Spanish royal family, they would remain in France. This was sold as protective custody, but even the notoriously dim Spanish Bourbon must have known by now that they didn't have any choice. They would at least be given a comfortable place of captivity. Napoleon chose Talleyrand's country estate to serve as their gilded cage, apparently without consulting Talleyrand or his wife. Charles and Maria Luisa were eventually permitted to leave for a less restrictive exile in Rome. They took up residence at the luxurious Palazzo Barberini, which still stands today. They died in 1819, within only a few weeks of each other, never having seen Spain again. Ferdinand would eventually reclaim the Spanish crown, although that's a very long story, and we will cover it extensively in the future. As for Manuel Godoy, he was not lying when he told Napoleon he planned to retire. As he had requested, he was allowed to keep his titles and properties. That might seem crazy given the underhanded means with which he had acquired them, but this was more or less standard practice in this era. The nobility was a very exclusive club, but once you were in, you were in. Godoy settled in Paris, where the income from his Spanish properties allowed him to live the comfortable life of an upper-class gentleman. I wonder how many eminent Parisians stood next to him at the Louvre, or sat next to him at the opera or the theater, never suspecting that they were in the company of one of the most infamous characters of the era. Godoy wrote memoirs, although it will probably not surprise you to hear that they are not considered reliable. Obviously, the sausage maker could never return to Spain, and his reputation precluded any kind of second act. But he was still a relatively young man, just 41 years old. He lived this quiet, comfortable life for decades, dying at the ripe old age of 84 in 1851. He lived long enough to see Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte become president of France, although not quite long enough to see him crown himself Emperor Napoleon III. Despite their father's infamy, Godoy's children were accepted as members of the European aristocracy in good standing. As far as I know, none of his descendants achieved anything of note, but despite his dramatic fall from grace, the sausage maker did ultimately succeed at his primary goal of elevating his family into the upper ranks of the nobility. Manuel Godoy, the sausage maker, the Prince of Peace. He was dishonest, corrupt, incompetent, unscrupulous, and a flagrant sexual predator. He habitually mistreated and betrayed those around him, with the exception of the king and queen. He broke the public trust and abused his power at every opportunity. I can't think of a single redeeming quality. He is, without a doubt, one of the worst people I have ever written about on this show, which is really saying something. And yet, I have to admit I will miss him. The utter shamelessness with which he embraced his greed and lust and ruthless ambition made him a perfect villain. And so, we bid farewell to a man who turned evil and selfishness into a form of art. Goodbye, sausage maker. Anyway, back in Spain, Joseph Bonaparte was on his way to his new capital. Almost as soon as he crossed the border, he began to feel misgivings about his new assignment. Joseph wrote to Napoleon, quote, "The fact is that not one Spaniard has come forward to me, except the small number of people who were at Bayonne. The others have hidden themselves away, frightened by the unanimous opinion of their compatriots. It seems no one has wanted to tell your majesty the truth. I cannot myself hide it from you. The fear inside me makes me see double. By leaving Naples, I have opened my life up to very hazardous circumstances." End quote. Perhaps Brother Louis had been wise to refuse the Spanish crown. Joseph was not imagining things. The Spanish people had already given him a nickname, the Intruder. He was about as popular as plagues or earthquakes, and he knew it. As we've discussed in past episodes, Joseph did have some of the skills that make a good politician. He was highly intelligent, a trained lawyer, and had extensive diplomatic experience from his time in the Foreign Service. He was very personable and charismatic, an absolutely world-class schmoozer. Almost everyone who met Joseph liked him. He seemed to know everyone and had connections everywhere. He definitely surpassed his brooding, temperamental brother Napoleon in this particular sphere of life. And of course, he was one of the few people in the world who actually had experience serving as a monarch of a major European country. But Joseph had deep flaws as well. He was not a man of action. He lacked the drive and audaciousness that animated Napoleon. He was very charming in person, but lacked Napoleon's skill in manipulating the masses. Joseph hated to be the center of attention. He preferred to fade into the background and exercise his influence behind the scenes. He was quite at home hosting a salon with a small select group, but presiding over the royal court, with everyone's eyes on him and his every word and gesture under the microscope, was like torture. He had trouble making decisions. Joseph could be quite valuable advising others, but when he was the one invested with authority, he tended to freeze up. As you might remember from episode 92, when Napoleon left Paris to go on campaign against the Prussians in 1806, he had appointed Joseph to serve as regent in his absence. Joseph's indecisiveness had proved to be a major problem, nearly leading the country to financial ruin. More capable men were forced to step in to fill the void, most notably Jean-Jacques Régis de Cambacérès. This was the man Napoleon had entrusted to reinvigorate the Spanish state. Whatever his other qualities, Joseph was not well suited to his new role. As you may have noticed in that quotation, Joseph was genuinely disturbed by how much the Spanish people hated him. This was another difference between him and Napoleon. The younger brother was definitely not afraid to play the tyrant when he felt it was necessary, even if it angered the public. He could detach his true self from his public persona. Joseph was not like that. There was a dark side to his charisma. He craved the affection of others. Someone less sensitive might have thought, well, they might hate me now, but I'll prove them all wrong. But for Joseph, unpopularity really stung. As we'll see in future episodes, he would have cause to fear for his life during his time as King of Spain. This, too, took a toll. He was not a risk-taker like his brother. He had never seen a battlefield and did not care to. In the years to come, Joseph would become increasingly nervous and unhappy. Faced with irresolvable emotional problems, he took solace in wine and brandy. Soon, his Spanish subjects would have another nickname for him, Joe Bottle. There are all kinds of ways to mark the different phases of the Napoleonic Wars. Different historians all have their own criteria and periodize the wars in their own ways. For me, this intervention in Iberia represents a new phase. I think Metternich was right. The Treaty of Tilsit really did change Napoleon's outlook. He had always been a gambler and always had a nearly messianic belief in his own abilities. But the risks he took were always well calculated, and his uncanny self-confidence had always remained grounded in reality, never lapsing into delusion. But the Russian alliance seems to have convinced Napoleon that there were no longer any practical limits to his power. As we saw in this episode, he didn't have to put Joseph on the Spanish throne. There were less provocative options on the table. Napoleon didn't care. He no longer thought he had to worry about inflaming public opinion or flouting diplomatic convention and the rule of law. After all, who could possibly stop him? This calculation had turned out to be mostly correct when it came to the Spanish nobility. By and large, they did not like Bonaparte and did not like France. But when he ordered them to come to Bayonne to have Joseph Bonaparte and a French constitution rammed down their throats, the vast majority saw no other option than to obey. Any halfway intelligent person with a good understanding of European geopolitics could see that poor little Spain was in no position to resist the greatest conqueror of the age and his unstoppable, undefeated army. But the Dos de Mayo uprising had proven that this view was not universal. However invincible the French Empire might have seemed to intelligent opinion, many Spaniards were willing to resist, even at the cost of their own lives. The insurgents of the Dos de Mayo knew the odds were against them, but they simply couldn't bear sitting idle while foreign soldiers occupied the country. As we've discussed in many past episodes, Napoleon never lost his fear of the Paris mob, gained through bitter experience of the darkest years of the Revolution. He always worked hard to avoid angering them, and even brought real improvements to their lives to ensure that they supported the regime. He seems not to have rated the people of Spain so highly. As Bonaparte plotted his takeover of Spanish politics, the average people didn't factor into his calculations at all. Perhaps that was understandable. Spain didn't really have any history of mass political action. Then again, before the 1780s, France hadn't either. Even before Joseph Bonaparte arrived in Madrid, the situation was already beginning to change. The events of the Dos de Mayo had proved that there was plenty of fighting spirit in Spain. The problem had not been any lack of will to resist, but the lack of any leadership willing to organize and channel all the anti-French feelings in the country into a real plan. In the wake of the uprising, that leadership had begun to emerge. Some within Spain had taken notice of the bravery of the people of Madrid. The Dos de Mayo would prove to be the spark that launched an inferno. But that's a story for next episode. As always, thanks for listening.